Good evening, I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. On the NewsHour tonight, the shutdown clock ticks down with Republicans still divided over how or whether to continue to fund the federal government.
California Democrat and the longest-serving woman in United States Senate history, Dianne Feinstein, passes away at the age of 90.
She would work with anyone to accomplish a result that was good for the country. She didn't think she had all the answers.
And several major retailers closed stores due to shoplifting, but questions remain about whether their concerns are overblown. Welcome to the NewsHour. Two major stories from Capitol Hill tonight. Congress has lost one of its longest-serving members, California Senator Dianne Feinstein. We'll look back on her life and career.
But first, House Republicans' highly partisan government funding plan has imploded on the chamber floor, leaving the country on the cusp of a shutdown. Congressional correspondent Lisa Desjardins is tracking the political drama and the probable real-world consequences and joins us now. Lisa, it's good to see you. So Kevin McCarthy's temporary funding bill failed earlier today. House Republicans just finished a meeting. So bring us up to speed. Where do we stand right now?
Now, you know I like to use weather as a way to describe the patterns happening in the U.S. Congress. Right now, this storm that we've seen approaching on the horizon is starting to hit. And by that, I mean, as you say, earlier today, the House failed to pass that Republican temporary spending bill and failed by quite a lot of votes, more than Republicans expected. 21 Republicans jumped ship on that. So now Kevin McCarthy has been talking to his Republicans, trying to see if they can come up with some kind of alternate plan. And my reporting at this moment is they haven't come up with an alternate plan. This after a morning where McCarthy took our questions and he said he himself would reject the plan, the bipartisan plan, moving through the Senate. Here's what he told us.
Would you sit here and ask me the question, why don't I surrender and just go with the Senate and ignore the problem? Is that the question you would ask? I pledged in taking this job to change Washington, to stand up for the American public.
And here's why we played that soundbite. McCarthy is trying to say that he is standing up for more spending cuts, a tighter fiscal plan, but border security, those kinds of things. That's the message he's putting out there. But we also know, Amna, that Republicans actually don't have a plan that does any of those things that they can agree on, much less one that can get the Democratic support needed in the U.S. Senate. We do not expect any more votes tonight, and we are waiting to see what Kevin McCarthy does next.
Clearly frustrated, Speaker McCarthy there. Well, Lisa, with the shutdown looking increasingly imminent now, let's just talk about what a shutdown would mean, right? So just in general, remind us what would happen.
This is where we're at right now. You know, we don't like to scare viewers unnecessarily, and we're going to be even measured about what we're facing here. Let's talk about it. First of all, government shutdown right now is set to begin on Sunday, 12:01 a.m. Most federal agencies would feel this shutdown. This means that essential workers would stay on the job, but other workers not deemed essential would be furloughed. They would stay home. Now, that puts pay at risk for some 6 million federal workers and federal contractors together. All in all, there are some agencies and programs that will continue. Social Security, Medicare, they are automatically funded. Those programs, if you have benefits through them, will continue to get those benefits. However, there could be things like if you want to apply for Social Security now, that itself could be on hold. Each agency will be affected differently, but I think we will see wide ripple effects around the country. Different localities affecting different things, and it will take time. Some paychecks are being given out today. That means in 2 weeks there could be a missing paycheck if we are still shut down at that point.
Lisa, you've been looking into potential specific impact on some really big programs that millions of people rely on, among them the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for women, infants, and children known as WIC. What would a shutdown mean for that?
We want to talk about the most vulnerable and the ones who might be the most affected. WIC, that is a program for low-income mothers and small children. Let's talk about it right now. About 7 million Americans, women and children, use that program. Now, shutdown effects vary because each state funds it a little bit differently in a formula with federal money. But some could, in fact, lose their benefits as soon as next week when they go to buy milk, formula. The money might not be there. In other places, people could be unaffected. And that is one of the problems of the shutdown. It is confusing and also creates a lot of difficulty for people to figure out where they stand.
It is confusing. I know you've also been looking into another program people know about called Meals on Wheels. How would that be affected in a shutdown?
That's right. And to go back, I should have also said we spoke to some of the people who are recipients of WIC, and here's what they said. Here's their concerns right now.
Easily, we go through like 4 or 5 gallons a month, you know, cereal, oatmeal, coffee, all that stuff. So losing that and the fresh food benefits, we get about $20 in $20 a month for fresh food and vegetables or frozen vegetables. And we use that for everything. If we lose WIC benefits, we will definitely eat less fresh food because they're so expensive.
So a serious situation there. And on Meals on Wheels, similar. How big is that program? 2.2 million seniors around this country use Meals on Wheels annually. Now, that program, about a third of it is federally funded. But even so, because that money is so important, it could, in fact, mean fewer meals, in some cases, no meals, depending on the situation in each locality. And again, talk to some people who are really thinking about this and potentially feeling it. Here's what those had to say.
It'll be catastrophic. We know that good nutrition, this breaking of the isolation, really reduces the number of people that go into the hospital. They're able to stay at home. And we can feed somebody for an entire year for what it costs for one day in the hospital. So we're going to pay as a country. But most importantly, our older adults are going to pay with their health.
Older adults, women and children, just some of the groups now really concerned about this shutdown expected to start on Sunday.
So, Lisa, that deadline is midnight on Saturday, September 30th, to reach a deal. What happens next?
Right. We are waiting for Speaker Kevin McCarthy to decide what he wants the House to do. We expect some kind of vote tomorrow in the House, but we really don't know what could pass over there. Meanwhile, the Senate is expected to vote on something there, also discussions about whether that includes border security or not. At this moment, like I say, the winds are blowing in cross directions here in Congress at a moment where you really think the country needs to move forward. Instead, there really seems to be a lot of confusion. Hopefully tomorrow will tell us more about the direction ahead. But right now, Amna, from where I stand, I really don't see a way out of this shutdown in this moment. One other note, though, lawmakers, they will automatically be paid. That has to do with the Constitution. They can opt to put their pay on hold. I asked Speaker Kevin McCarthy if he will do that, and he said he would. He said he will not be paid if the shutdown hits.
So congressional correspondent Lisa Desjardins covering the latest for us on Capitol Hill. Lisa, thank you.
You're welcome.
And now to the other major news out of the nation's capital. Trailblazing Senator Dianne Feinstein died at her home in Washington, D.C. last night.
Hours earlier, Feinstein cast what would be her final vote on the Senate floor. You see her right there in the purple blazer, raising her hand in favor of a short-term spending bill aimed at preventing a government shutdown.
And it's been a lot of years, so I want to thank everybody up here.
She was the U.S. Senate's oldest sitting senator.
Thank you.
Dianne Feinstein was elected to the chamber to represent California back in 1992. But the centrist Democrat was breaking gender barriers long before coming to Capitol Hill. Feinstein became San Francisco's first female mayor after a double assassination at City Hall in 1978. She led the city out of a particularly turbulent time after its mayor, George Moscone, and supervisor Harvey Milk, the city's first openly gay elected official, were gunned down by a fellow politician.
Both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk have been shot and killed.
Feinstein's calm and compassion also helped guide San Francisco's gay community through the AIDS epidemic that ravaged the city in the 1980s. In 1992, Feinstein won her seat in the U.S. Senate along with Barbara Boxer. They were the first women to ever represent California in the upper chamber. It was hailed as the year of the woman after a new wave of women were elected to the Senate and House. Feinstein became a passionate advocate for a wide range of issues, from reproductive rights to gun control.
Thank you. We've seen it in universities, we've seen them in elementary schools, and now we have seen them used against first graders. The time has come, America, to step up and ban these weapons.
One of her greatest legislative achievements came early in her career, an assault weapons ban she championed that then-President Bill Clinton signed into law in 1994. Feinstein also gained a reputation for reaching across the aisle to find compromise with Republicans, sometimes drawing scrutiny from liberals in her own party. She was the first woman to serve as the ranking Democrat on the Senate's powerful Judiciary Committee. She'd oversee a string of Supreme Court confirmation hearings, including one for then-nominee Brett Kavanaugh as he faced sexual assault allegations.
This behavior revealed a hostility and belligerence that is unbecoming of someone seeking to be elevated to the United States Supreme Court.
Feinstein was also the first woman to head the Senate Intelligence Committee. Under her leadership, the panel conducted a five-year investigation into the CIA's interrogation techniques during the George W. Bush administration.
Even if one were to set aside all of the moral arguments, our review was a meticulous and detailed examination of records. It finds that coercive interrogation techniques did not produce the vital, otherwise unavailable intelligence the CIA has claimed.
In her final years, Feinstein became more visibly frail and confused, triggering calls for her resignation. In February, she announced she would not be seeking a sixth term next year. Today, President Biden, who served with Feinstein in the Senate, reflected on her passing.
She was a historic figure, trailblazer for women, and a great friend. Diane made her mark on everything from national security to the environment, to gun safety, to protecting civil liberties. The country's going to miss her dearly, and so will Jill and I.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer echoed those sentiments on the Senate floor.
As the nation mourns this tremendous loss, we're comforted in knowing how many mountains Diane moved, how many lives she impacted, how many glass ceilings she shattered along the way. America, America is a better place because of Senator Dianne Feinstein.
Keeping with Senate tradition, her desk in the chamber was draped with a black cloth and adorned with a vase of flowers, a tribute to her long legacy of public service and trailblazing career. Dianne Feinstein was 90 years old.
For reflections on Dianne Feinstein's life, we turn to someone who knew her well, former California Congresswoman Jane Harman. She and Feinstein were elected to Congress on the same day back in 1992 and worked together for nearly two decades. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Jeff.
First, my condolences on the loss of your friend. You were with Senator Feinstein just last night. There was a private meeting just hours before she passed, and you shared with us this photo of your visit. Tell us about it.
Well, how lucky was I that it occurred to me about a day ago that I missed my friend Diane and I wanted to go by to see her. So I arranged to go yesterday afternoon, less than 24 hours ago, or just about 24 hours ago, to her home. And she and I sat in her study for an hour with her housekeeper coming back and forth and her little beloved dog, Kirby 2, in her lap, talking about the past, but also talking about the future. What people may not understand is that Diane was still in the arena, and she knew how much she could still do for California, especially appropriations for California. And we were talking about votes, and we were talking about her instinct to try to come up with some idea of how to bring the country together, what could be needed more, hours before our government might shut down. And I was blown away by how beautiful she looked, and how much, not just in the present, but in the future she was. And when I hugged and kissed her goodbye, and her housekeeper took that amazing photo, I expected to see my friend anytime soon. And I just shocked, as I think the whole country is, by her loss last evening.
Her career was one of many firsts. She was, of course, a trailblazer for women in politics. but also in terms of promoting progressive policy. She was behind the first congressional action on global warming. She secured the extension of the Violence Against Women Act until 2027. She also authored the 1994 assault weapons ban. What do you see as the sum total of her impact?
Oh, she was fearless. I don't know anybody more fearless than she was on behalf of things she cared about and thought were the right things to do. You could not budge her, not ever. The assault weapons ban is a great example because there, many members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I think maybe even then Senator Joe Biden, were much more hesitant to push ahead with that than she was. And she got it done with help in the committee. It passed the Senate, or I think it passed the Senate first, but I voted for it as a House member in my first term. Very risky vote for her, but also for me. And to remind, in 1994, the Democrats lost the majority. Newt Gingrich came to power. Diane and I were reelected. In my case, I was reelected by 811 votes out of 225,000 counted votes after a nine-month ordeal where not only was a count demanded, but there was an investigation by the House, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Looking back on that, Diane's leadership got me on the team. I think I would have supported it anyway, but I would never, ever, never have thought about not following Diane's lead. She was a marvel.
You know, questions about her health and her mental capacity in many ways shadowed what were her final years in office. Why did she ultimately refuse to resign, even amid the growing pressure from Democrats?
Oh, I fully understand that. And that's why, please show again the photograph of her yesterday standing next to me. She was beautiful. She was frail, but she was still in the fight. Her view was that she was elected by the citizens of California to her fourth term, I believe it was her fourth term, that she was there to be the most effective advocate for appropriations for money for California, which she was, and to fight for other things that were important for the country, which she did. And even yesterday, as I said, she was talking about things she wanted to do in the future. So why should she resign? She could function. Was it perfect? No, I think she would have admitted that. But her cognitive faculties were there and adequate for the fights for the present and the future. And it was her call, not somebody else's call. It really is sad. And as this has been pointed out by Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker Emerita of the House, that these things were said about a woman. They were never said about the men in the Senate, who were much more frail than Diane in their last days.
You know, I was struck by the fact that both President Biden and Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, in separate statements, they both said that they cherished their friendship with Senator Feinstein. And we are in this moment where mm-hmm. comedy and bipartisanship are in short supply in Congress. What did Senator Feinstein model for other lawmakers?
She modeled the fact that she would work with anyone to accomplish a result that was good for the country. She didn't think she had all the answers and everybody else was dumb. She thought she would bring her best self to the problem. And she had an excellent staff always, which would help provide her with material. She was well informed and she would listen and she would lead. And she did that with absolutely everybody. And I can't think of anyone in the Senate, I don't know some of the newbies, but anyone who worked with her over years who doesn't have a fond thought for her. And surely she worked with Mitch. Surely she did. Someone else she worked closely with, who is a dear friend of mine now, is Susan Collins of Maine, who was on the floor this morning passionately talking about Diane's leadership qualities.
She was a pioneer and a strong and dignified leader.
Lisa Murkowski was another. Patty Murray, a Democrat, was saying beautiful things about Diane on the Senate floor.
That was Diane. She did her job every day. She cared about her country.
And of course, her dear friend Nancy Pelosi has been all over this. And Nancy Pelosi's daughter, Nancy Corinne Pelosi, was an extraordinary support for Diane in her last days. So I don't know anyone who didn't value and learn from associating with Diane. I surely did.
You mentioned Senator Collins, and we can, of course, show the picture where Senator Collins brought the watercolor that Senator Feinstein had painted for her. She brought that to the floor of the Senate today as she spoke so beautifully about her friend. Former California Congresswoman Jane Harman, thank you so much for your time, and again, our condolences on the loss of your friend.
Thank you.
In the day's other headlines, the United Auto Workers strike expanded to two more Ford and GM plants in the Midwest. Some 7,000 union members walked off the job today to join picket lines. UAW President Sean Fain made the announcement in a video address.
I'm calling on Ford's Chicago assembly plant to stand up and go on strike. And I'm calling on GM's Lansing Delta Township to stand up and go out on strike. Our courageous members at these two plants are the next wave of reinforcements in our fight for record contracts.
The union did not expand the strike to any additional plants at Stellantis. Fain said that's because the company made a new offer today on pay raises and other issues. In Pakistan, suicide bombings killed at least 57 people today. In the first, a bomber targeted a religious celebration in the southwest, killing 52 people. The others died in the northwest when a mosque was attacked. Video from the first bombing showed charred personal items on the ground where some 500 people had gathered. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. The World Court called today for Azerbaijan to withdraw troops from sites in Nagorno-Karabakh. But there was no sign that Azerbaijan will comply after recapturing the region last week. Instead, the exodus of ethnic Armenians out of Nagorno-Karabakh neared 100,000, more than 80% of the population. UN and Red Cross officials say they're struggling to keep up.
We had been planning for evacuations to be a longer process. The evacuations this week have gone very, very fast, very high numbers of people, but as a result of that many people becoming stranded.
Officials said close to a third of the refugees are children. There's word tonight that migration toward the U.S. this year has hit record levels through the dangerous Darien Gap linking Colombia and Panama. Data from Panama shows more than 400,000 people made the trek through the jungle region as of the end of September. That figure is almost double the total number of crossings there for all of last year. Officials say children and babies account for more than half the total this year. Today marked 6 months that American journalist Evan Gershkovich has been jailed in Russia with no end in sight. The Wall Street Journal reporter is charged with espionage. He has denied it, and the U.S. State Department says he's being wrongfully detained. His latest appeal was denied earlier this month. The U.S. military's top officer, Army General Mark Milley, formally ended a four-year tenure today with a strongly worded defense of democracy. As chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Milley had a rocky relationship with then-President Trump. Today, as President Biden and Vice President Harris joined a farewell tribute at Fort Myer in Virginia, the general offered this apparent rebuke of Mr. Trump.
We don't take an oath to a king or a queen or to a tyrant or a dictator. And we don't take an oath to a wannabe dictator. We don't take an oath to an individual. We take an oath to the Constitution, and we take an oath the idea that it's America, and we're willing to die to protect it.
Air Force General Charles Brown was sworn in to succeed Milley as chair of Joint Chiefs. Police in Las Vegas say they finally scored a breakthrough in the drive-by killing of rapper Tupac Shakur back in 1996. A local man named Dwayne Davis was arrested today and charged with murder. He allegedly ordered the attack on a BMW that Shakur was riding in after a brawl at a casino. Investigators say Davis's 2019 memoir gave them crucial evidence. And an update to a story we brought you last year. A Texas jury has awarded nearly $2.5 million to an advocate for military victims of toxic burn pits. Leroy Torres alleged he was forced to resign as a state trooper in 2012. He said he needed accommodation because of lung damage caused by exposure to burn pits in Iraq. Torres co-founded the group Burn Pits 360 to help other veterans exposed to toxic chemicals. The U.S. Supreme Court announced today it will consider whether state laws regulating social media platforms violate the Constitution. The statutes were enacted by Republican lawmakers in Texas and Florida. They bar companies from censoring users based on their viewpoints. The industry argues the laws make it harder to curb extremism and hate speech. And on Wall Street, stocks limped into the weekend amid ongoing worries about interest rates. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 159 points to close at 33,507. The NASDAQ rose 18 points. The S&P 500 gave up 11. And still to come on the NewsHour, David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart weigh in on the week's political headlines. And actor Cheech Marin helps to open a permanent showcase exclusively dedicated to Chicano art.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Target announced this week that it's planning to close several stores, citing retail theft and organized retail crime as major problems. It's raising growing concerns and questions about whether retail theft is getting worse and what can be done about it.
The retail giant said it will close 9 stores in 4 states next month, including in New York City, the San Francisco Bay Area, Portland, and Seattle. Target said it was doing so out of concern about the safety of workers and customers. Target's decision comes as multiple other retailers, including CVS, Macy's, and Walmart, say theft has become a significant problem for their bottom lines. Retailers are locking up more merchandise, saying there's a notable rise in organized theft, where 2 or more people grab merchandise and then resell it. Others point to a disturbing number of smash-and-grab robberies, including looting in Philadelphia earlier this week. The National Retail Federation said its latest survey of members found that inventory loss cost retailers about $112 billion. But some industry observers say those numbers are not clear and may be masking other problems, including internal theft by employees. Last winter, a former Walgreens executive acknowledged during an earnings call that maybe we cried too much last year when it came to characterizing theft at its stores. But incidents like 2 nights of looting in Philadelphia are angering business owners and alarming residents.
It's just happening too often, and it's just terribly, terribly upsetting. You know, my children are like, you have to move out of the city, and this is where I live, though.
Those robberies started Tuesday after an earlier protest when charges were dropped against an officer who shot and killed a man during a traffic stop. Philadelphia police insist the lootings were not connected to the protests. But some residents took issue, saying anger over the police could not be discounted.
Let's dig deeper into this. We're joined by Gabrielle Fonrouge, who covers the retail industry for CNBC. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you've got these major retailers. They're blaming a spike in theft for their decision to close some stores. Is retail theft actually getting worse, according to the data?
You know, the problem is that there's really no good data out there. It's a difficult thing to measure. You can look at crime rates for certain jurisdictions, but they're not going to break it down by specifically retail crime. You're just going to see overall larceny arrests. And the National Retail Federation, it's one of the largest trade associations in the world. It's the trade association for the retail industry. They conduct an annual survey on shrink, which is lost inventory, which includes things like retail crime. They just came out with their survey, and it's, once again, not really conclusive. What you'll see is that retail crime increased, or shrink overall increased, to $112 billion in 2022. That's up from $93.9 billion in the prior year. But what they do is they apply the rate of lost inventory to total U.S. retail sales. So as total retail sales grow, so does that number. That doesn't actually really tell us that much.
So then are there instances where companies are using theft as the reason for a store closure to cover up underperformance or to cover up mismanagement?
Yeah, so what we've learned in our reporting is that the retailers who are talking about shrink, lost inventory, and specifically retail crime on their earnings calls when they're talking to their investors and things like that, they like to blame retail crime specifically and organized retail crime. But what my reporting has found is that it can often be internal issues that can lead to these high shrink numbers, these lost inventory. You know, things like employee theft is part of it. That's hiring people who end up stealing from you. Also having poor inventory management, not knowing where all of your stuff is along the supply chain. When you think about where an item is manufactured all the way down to the store level, things get lost. And at the same time, retailers are under a lot of pressure from a host of places. Right now, consumers aren't really spending as much on discretionary goods. They're really keeping it solely on necessities. So they are facing pressure from all of these places, and they're more likely to talk about the impact of shrink.
Still, though, there's no denying the uptick in what are these brazen mob-style smash-and-grab robberies that are plaguing big-box stores, they're plaguing upscale retailers. How are companies responding to that?
Yeah, so, I mean, you're completely right. We've all seen the videos. These are viral videos showing people running in, grabbing stuff. But these are also isolated incidents, right? When you see these things on the news every single day, when you read them in the paper, you must feel like, wow, every retail store is under attack. But when you look at the numbers, that shrink percentage that the NRF came out with, that shows how much inventory retailers are losing as a percentage of sales. And it came out to 1.57. And so a healthy shrink number, every retailer, every company has to plan for lost inventory. It is a cost of doing business. And the amount that they plan for is anywhere between 1% to 2.5%. So in the latest survey, it showed 1.57%. That is considered a healthy lost inventory rate. That if it was at 3%, we'd be having a different conversation. And what retailers are doing about this, they are using their economic muscle. They're using their influence to pass legislation, to influence lawmakers, to get that legislation passed the finish line that imposes stricter penalties for our organized retail crime offenses.
Well, I was going to raise that as a question to you, because adding to this problem, you've got the decriminalization of low-level offenses in some states that has created an opportunity for people, for criminals, really, to exploit the system. And once an item is stolen, there are many ways now for someone to resell that item without any sort of monitoring or interference from law enforcement. How are retailers responding to that and talking about it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it is easier than ever to resell stolen goods, and that is absolutely an issue. Last year, Congress passed the Inform Act, which requires digital marketplaces such as Amazon, eBay, but even smaller places to disclose the identity of high-volume sellers. So to make it easier for law enforcement to track down those people who are stealing large amounts of goods and then reselling them online, that's one part of it that's already gotten past the finish line. You know, and the next one that they're looking towards is the Combating Organized Retail Crime Act. And that kind of touches on this idea of the number that you have to reach in order for it to be a felony offense. Part of the problem is you have repeat offenders who will steal small amounts of goods over time. So $100 here, $200 there, $300 here. That's all going to be misdemeanor offenses. And prosecutors aren't going to really, they're going to get programs. It's going to get pled down to violations, things like that. There's not going to be any really strict penalties. So what they're working to do at the federal level and at the state level is to take these offenses as aggregate offenses. So, for example, I believe in Florida, their felony theft threshold is $700, and they're changing it to be on an aggregate basis. So if you steal 100 here, 300 here within a 12-month period, if it reaches that number, then you're going to get charged with a felony. And that's what they hope to, you know, will stop these repeat offenders.
Gabrielle Fonrouge of CNBC, thanks for helping us make sense of all this. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a hectic week in Washington as the country barrels toward a government shutdown and hearings begin in House Republicans' impeachment inquiry of President Biden. We turn now to the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That is New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post. Welcome. Good to see you.
Hi, I'm good to see you.
Let's start with this shutdown because we are, as Lisa reported earlier, hurtling towards another government shutdown. And Jonathan, they have become more commonplace in recent history. We are here not because two parties don't agree, but because Republicans can't agree amongst themselves. Could this have been avoided?
No. And it's not Republicans arguing amongst themselves. It's House Republicans arguing amongst themselves. It was fascinating to see that clip that Lisa played of the speaker yelling, saying, do you want me to surrender to the Senate? As an American, yes, please, surrender to the Senate. Why? Because over in the Senate, there's a bipartisan effort at a continuing resolution with Republicans and Democrats coming together. They're supposed to vote tomorrow, and hopefully it will vote out and put pressure on the speaker to take yes for an answer and keep the government open. But the speaker has been enthrall to the MAGA minority within his majority that has been able to scuttle rule votes, scuttle continuing resolution votes, and not just by one or two votes. The last vote they just did, 21 Republicans voted it down. So yes, we're going to a shutdown. It was inevitable. The key question is, for how long will this shutdown last?
David, what is Speaker McCarthy's strategy here? To Jonathan's point, it seems to be to placate that minority of far-right Republicans so far.
Yeah, I really don't. I have trouble seeing how this ends. Because in theory, it would end when he did a deal with the Democrats and they got Republicans and Democrats together. But that seems to be an impossibility. So this really could go on a long time. And to me, it's I wouldn't say it's inevitable, but to find the fork in the road that led us to this spot, I'd go back to the 1990s and back to Newt Gingrich, where you really had the beginning of departure, of make-believe departure from reality. And compared to today's crew, Newt Gingrich looks like Plato and Socrates, because they actually had a plan. They wanted to cut government spending, and they had a plan to cut. And John Kasich, and who was then in the House, wanted to cut government spending. Here was the things he wanted to cut. These guys today, they have no plan. They're not going to touch taxes. They're not going to touch entitlements. It's just all make-believe. And it's a lesson that once you start pretending to other people, you end up lying to yourself. And so I think they firmly believe they're doing something constructive here. And I have sympathy with the idea that the deficits are too big. They're just not serious. And they've taken flight from reality, and it's become make-believe.
Lisa did a wonderful job of touching on a few of the potential impacts here, because we talk about shutdowns like it's a political problem, but this, it hits home in people's communities and in their lives. And we know, we've seen White House economists and private banks come out with the kind of estimates that say, oh, we could see reduced growth and so on. But Jonathan, how are you looking at the potential impact of this? What does this mean?
Well, I think when people think of shutdowns, they think of national parks being closed. On my way here, I saw the bicycle fencing going up around the Lincoln Memorial, because that will be closed if the government shuts down. But if you look at there's a private Facebook group called FedFam, and it was started, full disclosure, by a friend of mine during the 2019 government shutdown, which is the longest government shutdown in history. And it was federal workers pooling their resources together in terms of information about where to get food, where to get assistance, some people offering help, most people looking for help. That Facebook group now has more than 30,000 members. And over the weeks leading up to what is going to happen tomorrow, they've been gaining 200, 300 new members a day. There, folks like to rip Washington, talk about the bureaucrats, these faceless bureaucrats are doing this or doing that. These are real people who are among the American people who live paycheck to paycheck. And a lot of those federal workers, yes, some will get back pay once the government reopens, but a lot of them are contractors who will not be repaid. And I'm thinking about cafeteria workers.
David, the economists seem to agree that the economy is strong enough right now that a short-term shutdown would not do much lasting damage. The longer, of course, it goes on, the more potential damage it could inflict. But when you look at this fact that this economic context today is very different from the years of shutdowns past, right? There's a number of different headwinds ahead. You've got auto workers still on strike. You've got the restarting of federal student loan payments next month as well. Are Republicans you talk to, are they worried that this could actually critically hurt the economy the longer
Some
it goes down?
Some of them aren't. I mean, the Republicans are genuinely divided on this, and it's a mystery to me why they can't find a strategy to go forward. Gas prices are also shooting up.
Yeah.
And there was a study that found that it would cut GDP 0.2% per week. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't sound like a lot, but you add up a bunch of weeks, and that really does begin to sound like a lot. And then there's the psychological effect on how businesses feel comfortable, how much consumer confidence there is. And we're at that moment. People have been predicting a recession for like a year and a half, and we've been fortunate enough to avoid it. But we're now at the precarious moment where it seemed before all this that we could slip into it. So that could happen. And then the other blow, aside from, we should focus on the WIC people you and Lisa talked about, people are really vulnerable and just need support. But then there's the overarching matter of public trust. The Republican Party used to be the party, you weren't thrilled by them, but they were the business party. Mm. They knew how to run things. And that seems like eons or light years ago. And so one of the things that's bound to sow distrust in institutions, distrust in government, is stopping your work in the middle of nothing. Like, that's what's going to happen. And so the blow to public cynicism, the increase in public citizen, the blow to public distrust. Those are psychological things that will just cause more people to be even more contemptuous of government.
Speaking of the Republican Party, there are three events this week I want to get both of your takes on that kind of give us insight into where the party is right now in the larger moment in political history. We had, of course, the top seven Republican candidates for president participating in the second debate in California. The stage did not include the leading candidate, Donald Trump, who held a rally in Michigan instead, addressing auto workers. And then on Thursday, House Republicans held their first public hearing for the impeachment inquiry into President Biden, where no new evidence was presented linking him to any impeachable offense. Jonathan, what do all of these pull together kind of tell us about where the party is and its priorities?
There's a GIF that I love to use for moments like these, and it is a dumpster on fire. That is literally, that is what the Republican Party is. You look at what we're talking about in terms of the shutdown, no leadership from the Republican Speaker of the House to prevent a government shutdown. On the other side, you have the Republican Chairman of the House Oversight Committee leading a sham impeachment inquiry where their own witnesses came in and said, there's no evidence here yet. And then on that debate stage, a debate that I tuned into and turned away from because I couldn't understand what anyone was saying because everyone's talking over each other. And what I could hear was offensive on so many levels. And then on top of that, the leading candidate by 43 points in the latest NBC News poll above Ron DeSantis, has four indictments and 91 counts in four different jurisdictions. The Republican Party it's either aimless when it comes to governing, or it's going down the road to autocracy when it comes to the presidential level. And quite honestly, as an American, that breaks my heart because this country has been run on a two-party system, but it requires two strong parties. And right now, there's only one.
David, how do you look at it?
Well, I agree with a lot of what Jonathan said, except for we only have one strong party, because this is working for them. All the stuff you mentioned, that's totally working for them. To me, one of the symptomatic moments of this week was a story in my paper today. The Club for Growth is a very conservative, sort of libertarian free market, Republican conservative outfit that has been spending millions of dollars to run ads against Donald Trump. And a document, their own internal document was leaked, and it turns out they found that those ads are doing nothing. That Donald Trump, some of the ads, if they mention January 6th, it helps Donald Trump. And so I think the upshot of that is that this is Donald Trump's party. Donald Trump's party more than ever before. And it's also true that he is politically stronger than he's ever been before in a political sense. So he, you know, the Washington Post poll was an outlier, but he was leading Joe Biden by a chunk. And so we have to think seriously about why is what they're doing working. Because by what I know and by my own aesthetic and moral sensibility, it should not be working. And, you know, the Republican donor class is now in a panic to try to lure Governor Glenn Youngkin from Virginia into the race, which is just fantasy land. Like, what does Glenn Youngkin bring that Nikki Haley doesn't bring? It's not finding some magic figure who can take down Donald Trump. It's Donald Trump's party, and it's working. And so Well, that's a scary thing, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Look, before we go, in the minute or half or so we have left, I did want to ask each of you if you wanted to say something brief on the passing of Senator Dianne Feinstein, an absolute giant, an icon in politics and the Senate. David?
Yeah, I learned from the obituaries today what a rough childhood she had. She had a mom who had some mental health issues, flew into sulfuric rages, and what a hard childhood she had. And then even up to age 45, her political career looked to be over. But that childhood had prepared her with the resilience to be tough at the horrible moment in San Francisco when the mayor was and the council member were killed, and it enabled her to be tough in the Senate. The one thing we all knew about Dianne Feinstein is she was a very tough person. I saw a Willie Brown quote from California, said, she shouldn't be a politician. She doesn't play any games. She's just direct. and that was true of Dianne Feinstein.
Jonathan.
Senator Feinstein, I really came into my consciousness in 92 when she was elected in the, quote, year of the woman, part of that, the vanguard of women in the Senate. And then she was at pivotal moments in our history. The Clarence Thomas hearings, the investigation into torture. Yeah, she was tough as nails. She was an excellent senator. She was also someone who was sort of a moral rock and a conscience. She was a centrist, and not willing to be swayed one way or another, but was willing to talk and work and compromise because she took governing seriously. We lost a giant in American government.
So many followed in her footsteps as well. Our thoughts are with her family and loved ones. Jonathan Capehart, David Brooks, great to see you. Thank you.
Thank you. You too.
For many people, Cheech Marin is a household name, the comedian and actor best known as part of the countercultural duo Cheech and Chong. But he's also an avid collector of Chicano art and opened the first major museum entirely devoted to that 2 summers ago. Jeffrey Brown visited the Cheech Art Museum for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
On a recent hot September evening in Riverside, California, a majority Latino city an hour east of Los Angeles, many families and individuals headed indoors. And it was art, lots of it, that brought them. The Cheech Marin Center for Chicano Art and Culture, known to one and all as simply the Cheech, is part of the Riverside Art Museum. Thanks to a partnership between the city, the museum, and comedian and actor Cheech Marin, it's home to hundreds of works of art by dozens of Chicano artists. And it began with Cheech's personal collection.
What do you see when you look around right now?
You know, I see children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, you know, because I've been collecting for a long time. There was no big collectors out there for Chicano art, you know. There was nobody collecting on the scale that I was, because it was an unknown quantity.
What was it? I mean, what did you see?
I saw a reflection of culture, Mexican culture in an American setting, and that was Chicano. It's the coolest art out there.
I've been smoking since I was born, man. I could smoke anything.
Marin gained fame in the 1970s and 80s as one half of the comedy duo Cheech and Chong. He was a regular on TV and in films like Born in East L.A., which Cheech also wrote and directed. He himself was born in South Central Los Angeles to Mexican-American parents. And from an early age, he took an interest in art.
Every Saturday, I would go to the library. Look at all the art books, and okay, that's Picasso. Is that how you say that? Picasso, okay? Yeah. And that's Michelangelo, and you know. So by the time I, you know, in a little while, I knew a lot about art.
You know? But you weren't seeing art, you weren't seeing Chicano art in those books.
No, you were barely seeing Chicanos, much less their art. I knew kind of what the culture was, you know, and it was always defined from the outside, not from the inside of the culture.
So he brought the art inside, over decades amassing a collection of more than 700 pieces from a variety of artists, including now well-known LA-born painters Frank Romero and Patsy Valdez, Texas-based Ricardo Ruiz, and younger mixed-media artists like Shizu Saldamondo. He curated an exhibition called Chicano Visions, American Painters on the Verge, that traveled to major art museums in 15 cities between 2001 and 2007. It would prove groundbreaking.
I knew it was an important moment, you know, because I could see the reaction to not only within the community, but outside of the community, to, oh, we've never seen this art in that kind of, we never really noticed that this art before. And that all changed when they started opening the crates.
Was there a sense from you and maybe from the artists of why did this take so long?
Well, sure. Sure, of course, you know, because, you know, some artists had gone through their whole career and never got recognized, you know, and they were making work that would be recognized later, but, you know, it was frustrating for them not to be turned away not only from museums but from galleries, too.
75-year-old Judith Hernandez knows that feeling all too well. She grew up in L.A. and was a leading figure in the Chicano art movement of the 1960s and 70s.
We didn't exist for the mainstream art world. I mean, what we did as art wasn't considered art at all. So we made our own galleries. We had our own exhibitions.
It took decades, but her work was eventually acquired by institutions like the L.A. County Museum of Art and the Smithsonian. Hernandez says progress, especially for Chicana women, has been slow.
From young women that I talk to these days, it hasn't changed a lot. It is still, you know, very male-dominated. Women's work still has a very hard time getting into museums, as we all know.
Early next year, she's finally having her first major retrospective, and it's happening at the Cheech. In fact, hers will be the first of its kind at the new museum.
Having an exhibition of this size is remarkable for me. I haven't had many solo shows. I don't know what I'll feel like the day that it opens. I've never seen that much of my own work in one place. It's very humbling.
It's what Maria Esther Fernandez, the Cheech's artistic director, calls filling the education and exhibition gap.
A lot of artists who are major artists in the Chicano movement that have not had solo shows, mid-career shows, much less a major retrospective now in the later years of their lives. One goal is to feature those exhibitions and have a space where we can do them regularly, not every 5 years.
And it's not just major artists that they're focused on. Upon entering the Cheech, the first pieces of art that visitors see are part of a community gallery featuring local and younger artists.
At the ethos of what Chicanx art is coming out of the movement, was engaging community. And so it's important for us, if we're going to be an institution, that we not replicate some of the museum models that have historically disenfranchised our community, that we engage them, that we bring them in as part of the curatorial aims and goals.
Fernandez stresses that Chicano art has evolved over the years. That's on display in the museum's upstairs gallery in a traveling exhibition titled Chican AOX Body, with contemporary artists exploring the brown body in a wide variety of forms and styles.
Art tells us our history, especially for those of us who maybe aren't written into the history books. And so I think it's important for folks to also understand that this art plays that role.
There are still many gaps to fill. By one count, fewer than 3% of artists in major U.S. museum collections are Latino.
So this museum, did it feel necessary to you in some way?
I think it felt inevitable, not necessary.
How did you feel when it opened? I mean, how did you feel personally when you stood here for the first time?
You know, I felt very proud, what's the word? It's like watching your kids go off to college. They may come back, they may not. If we can make it past 20 years, then we're kind of in the club. You know, that's what they told me.
in the big club in of the art world.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, so okay, I hope I live that long, but it's spawning a lot of relatives all around the country now. So now people know, I know what that Chicano art is, you know. I've seen a couple of things, you know. I would like to see more.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown at the Cheech in Riverside, California.
That is phenomenal. I want to visit the Cheech the next time I'm in California.
Absolutely. Count me in.
And don't forget to watch Washington Week. Tonight on PBS, moderator Jeffrey Goldberg and his panel discuss the now all but inevitable government shutdown.
And on PBS News Weekend tomorrow, after record-breaking heat this summer, we look at why certain parts of cities like Austin, Texas, are hotter than others. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us.